good morning, diners, travelers, the pursuers of the good life, and Peter.
Oh, there you go. I'm not a pursuer of the good life.
Why don't you set up this particular show, because you're very involved with this Pittsburgh Wine Festival.
In honor of the Pittsburgh Wine Festival, a great event, incidental listeners, that you should come from far and wide to attend. It's on April 30th. It's at Heinz Field in both the East and the West club sections. More than 150 wine makers from around the world pouring goodness knows how many wines. It's just an absolutely great event. And in the interest of stimulating your interest in wines from outside of the United States, which the wine festival's strongly trying to do this year, it's sort of one of their themes that American wine drinkers are now discovering the rest of the world as well. We reached far and wide for a very interesting but not very well-known winery in a region in Spain called the Ribera del Duero. And the owner and winemaker of Torremolinos Vineyard called all the way from Spain to talk to us the other day. So we'll bring you that interview. And don't forget to get information about the festival. Go to www.pittsburghwinefestival.com. And, of course, on the menu, we'll see you there. On the menu is a fascinating guest calling from a long way away, Ricardo Penalba. He's a winemaker with Finca Torremolinos in somewhere in central Spain. And I'm going to ask him to explain just exactly where in central Spain that is. Ricardo, welcome to On the Menu.
Yes.
Tell me where you are in Spain.
Well, I'm in Finca Torremolinos. Finca Torremolinos is in Aranda de Duero. Aranda de Duero is just the middle of Ribera del Duero wine region. And to give you an idea, I'm about 1.5 hours away from Madrid, which is the capital from Spain. About 3 hours south from France.
Yeah. Now, Ribera del Duero is an up and coming appellation in Spain. The one that's perhaps more familiar to Spanish wine lovers around the world is Rioja. But you work with the same grape as is famous in Rioja, correct?
Yes. With Tempranillo.
Now, I have a note here. We're going to talk some more about your background. But you were kind enough to admit that your first fermentation of red wine in 2001 was a disaster, but you did have a successful white wine fermentation in 2004. Now, that's a little bit unusual, isn't it, to be making a white wine in Ribera del Duero?
Well, yeah, that's true. but it's because legally we cannot make white wines in Ribera del Duero.
Oh, I see. So you made some anyway.
Yeah. Well, we have been making trials since 1990 to do white wines. But actually, I think this is a political problem that we cannot produce white wine in Ribera del Duero. I think they're scared that we can make one of the most prestigious white wines in the world, so they want to protect the local Spanish markets of white wines.
Yeah, because there are white wines made in the Rioja region, correct?
Yes,
it's allowed. Yeah. Your family bought the vineyard, you said, in 1974.
Yes.
And so you grew up there, but you grew up, and as a teenager, you were interested in other things and not very interested in making or drinking wine. Tell us how your view changed. I mean, why did you decide you were interested?
When you're a kid and you're forced to be in a certain atmosphere, You don't really like to be, in a place where you have no choice in some way. So since I was 7 or 8 years old, I will be traveling with my parents to different wineries all over the world and visiting wine tastings and always, at home with wine, taste these wines, tell me what you think about it. So you try to escape from it. So I decided to go to Bordeaux to study in a business school. And then in Bordeaux is when I started really to appreciate what I have at home, because you start to compare what you get in that area, in Bordeaux area, which were our local wines and even all other local things. And you start to realize how good are the things that come from your place. Actually, we have Ribera del Duero is one of the extremest areas in the world for wine production, for quality wine, actually.
Now, I think on your website you refer to the climate of Ribera del Duero being particularly good for winemaking because it's very cold in the winter.
Yes.
But then it's very hot and dry in the summer. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, well, actually, it's cold in winter, but what we have here, Ribera del Duero, to give you an idea, is at the height approximately of 3,000 feet. So that means that we are quite high. And the difference between day and night is quite big, because depending on the sun, we are going to be heating more. So we have a lot of decalage thermique in here. You can have winters minus 20 degrees during before the morning, you know, the hour, and then you can have 5 degrees during the day, and in summertime you can have 45 degrees at daytime, at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and maybe 10 degrees, you know, in the morning, you know, at Celsius, not Fahrenheit.
Yes. Yeah, I was just going to point that out. So 45 degrees Celsius is pretty hot. We won't do the conversion on air, but somebody told us recently, we were in the Rioja region recently, and someone there told us something very interesting. They said that the cold winter is very good for the vines, because it means that they absolutely go to sleep, so then they rest and then they waken up again in the springtime. Is that the way you look at it?
Well, yeah, no, actually the vineyard belongs to this kind of weather. The vineyard, they have to go to sleep, they have to get rest. But also, you know, the cold temperatures are very good for healing, calming down all the diseases and insects, you know.
Good, yes, yes.
It's very healthy to have cold and dry winters, because here the weather is dry. So, you know, at night, at winter time, it's like everything gets healthier because of the cold temperatures.
Now, your winemaking methods are still a little unusual in Spain, you said, because you're all organic and you're also experimenting with biodynamic. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, actually, it's just to have a reasonable philosophy about life and agriculture. You have to think that we have been producing wine for more than 5,000 years in this area. So wine is maybe the oldest tradition that we have kept. Wine is agriculture. 90% of the quality from the wine comes from the grape. So in the last 15 years, everything was organic in here. In this area, so it was when Ribera del Duero started to be popular 15 years ago, that all these synthetic chemical products started to get in through the hands of some people. And actually, I think when you don't work organic, it's something like going against quality. You know, if you look for agricultural products, you have to think that wine has been produced the same way for the last 12,000 years.
Now, biodynamic is even perhaps a little bit more extreme than just organic?
Yeah, well, biodynamic is looking for ancestral methods. It's just being conscious that we believe in living systems where there are many more elements which are related, such as the moon, the planets, the stars. And, it's just opening your eyes to the energies. You know, it depends on the way you do things. Things can change. So, biodynamic is something more complex. It's being a little bit more curious about the way of working things.
Now, how's it going so far?
We're like 1% of the product, biodynamic, mainly for wine of our school cycle, and we look for the total harmony.
Now, Ricardo, it's actually not. It might seem like a coincidence to our listeners that we are actually talking today, but there's a reason behind that, because you're going to make a long journey in the month of April. You're coming all the way to Pittsburgh for the Pittsburgh Wine Festival. Why did you decide to do that?
Why did I decide to do that, to go to Pittsburgh?
Yeah, I mean, you've never been to Pittsburgh before. I can assure you, yeah. It's a wonderful city. You'll have a wonderful time. And it's a great big festival. But I'm interested in how it was that you chose to select to come here.
Well, first, you don't know the place. So there is always a reason to get to know a new place. And, I heard that people like wine over there. So, you know, I like to be where the people like wine and to be able to talk about what we do and to present the taste of our soils and our weather. So I think it's a good opportunity to know in both relations, you know, me to know Pittsburgh and Pittsburgh to know me.
I think you will enjoy the environment. You'll be with literally 150 other winemakers, probably about half from the United States, about half from the rest of the world. And the people from the festival have been telling us that Pittsburgh wine drinkers and American wine drinkers generally are broadening their interest in wines from around the world rather than simply shopping at home. And wines from Spain, and especially wines from a region like Ribera del Duero will be in a minority, and I think it will be a very interesting evening for everyone to really enjoy and take advantage of what it is that people like Ricardo and Finca Torremolinos have to offer. Do you have a last thought for us before we sign off, Ricardo, so that you can go back and take care of those grapes?
Yeah, well, my advertise for you today is that remember that life is too short to drink bad wine. So don't waste your time.
Now, can you say that in Spanish?
La vida es demasiado corta para beber mal vino.
And is it in fact a saying in Spanish as well? I know it's an English expression.
Yeah, well, it sounds good in both directions.
Oh, now we have
here in Spain, what we will say is that the water is bad because it destroys the trials. So imagine what water can do to your intestines.
Well, let me
say drink wine.
Let me give you a couple of other phrases that are popular here. One is attributed to the great American Benjamin Franklin. He reportedly said that wine is a constant reminder that God loves us. And then there's a restaurant here in Pittsburgh called the Sonoma Grill, and their motto is, "A day without wine is like a day without sunshine."
Yeah, I hear that.
I'm sure you can translate those into Spanish, and everyone in Spain will understand. And
yes, and the one with the sunshine, I heard it before.
And Ricardo, we will look forward to meeting you when you come to Pittsburgh and drinking some of your wine with you. And thank you so much for joining us today on the menu.
Thank you. Have a nice day.
Now, do that again in Spanish.
Well, gracias. Y que tengas un buen día.
Thank you so much.
And now we'll take a break, but don't go away because there's more Wines from Spain on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Email us, please, onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com, and come blog with us at onthemenuradio.blogspot.com and Twitter with me.
What about Twittering with Miss Ann?
Yeah, and that's OTM Dish. How about that?
Yeah, I'm not really quite sure what that means. We could take that.
I don't know.
And we could take that any number of different ways. Now we're staying on a theme. We sometimes do that program to program. You can just never tell quite what we're going to do next. And this time we're going to talk about wines from a region of Spain that's not very well known, and they decided to do something about it. So the whole of the wine community from the province of Navarre came over to New York a couple of months ago, and we had a chance to catch up with a spokesperson for Wines of Navarre, who was a very interesting interview, and there's some very interesting wines coming from this region, and you'll know more about it as you listen to what she had to say. Listeners, you know that one of Peter's favorite things to do for On the Menu is to go to school to find out about wines that he doesn't know about. So today we're in New York City, we're at a day dedicated to the wines of Navarre, a very unusual region in Spain, and we have the opportunity to talk to Pilar Garcia, who is the president of the DO Regulatory Council for the Wines of Navarre. And I can tell you from hearing speak this morning, that she's a real expert on this region. But I think, Pilar, you can't really understand the wine identity of Navarre without understanding something of its history. So tell us a little bit about...
Yes, that's true, because Navarre is very close to the French border, and Navarre was a kingdom. It was the last kingdom to be incorporated to the Kingdom of Spain. We are talking about the 1512. So Navarre has had a lot of French kings, and that's why our wines sometimes can remind a bit to the French wine, Bordeaux style.
Well, you said something very interesting in your presentation this morning. You said that French winemakers say that the grape Grenache came from France, but in fact it really didn't.
Yes, that's true, because the real name is Garnacha, but Garnacha crossed the border, and then French people changed the name into Grenache. But the origin is between Navarre and La Rioja in the north of Spain.
Now, it's really very interesting. In the materials that you gave us today, you're still referring to Navarre as a kingdom.
Yes.
But it's really more like an autonomous region in Spain, correct?
Yes, that's true. But we are very related with our history. If you have the opportunity to travel to Navarre, you are going to see castles, you are going to see churches, you are going to see a lot of places, historical places, that reminds you that you are in a very old kingdom.
But we came to talk about wine, so wine has been a tradition in the region for a long time, but I think it's fair to say that your group has been really trying to bring Navarre wines up to date.
Yes, that's true. I'm the new president, council, for 1 year and a half, and in this moment we are making a big effort to demonstrate that our wines are very modern. Navarre has a very nice choice of wines. You are going to find white wines, rosé wines, red wines, sweet wines, in a very fresh and fruity style.
Now, this is something that the Italian government really worked hard on, trying
yes.
to improve the consistency and the quality of wines. Is your job to do the same thing?
Yes, because I think they are too many wines without any interest in the world. I think if we do have to have a succeed, to have really very, very good wines. So we are very, very demanding with the quality of our wines.
Now, you have an unusual range, but the wines are predominantly red wines?
Yes, 70% are red wines, 25% are red wines, and more or less 5% are white wines.
Sorry, we missed one in the middle of that. 25% is rosé wines, correct?
Yes, 25% is rosé wines. Yes, I made a mistake. 25% is rosé wines, 5% is white wines.
So that's really quite... Is that unusual in Spain?
No, yes, it's a bit unusual, because in Spain we have some regions that are producing only white wines. Some regions are producing only red wines. I think we have a wide selection of wines.
Now, you're particularly fond of the rosé wines, I think. And
yes, that's true.
And you or one of your colleagues said that the way that you get the juice from the
yes.
rosé grapes is very interesting, because you use Garnacha.
Yes.
But you don't press the grapes.
We don't press the grapes. We put all together the skins with the mast in the same tank, and we allow the color and the aromas to get into the mast. So after 8, 10, 24 hours, no more than that, we take out the mast and we make the fermentation with the colored mast. So the way of doing is completely different. We call it rosé by tears.
Yeah, the lacrima, right?
Yeah, lacrima.
But it's so listeners, if you never tried a Navarre Garnacha based rosé,
yes.
you're in for a treat, because it's really quite remarkably different than the rosés that come from other parts of France, like Bandol and other parts
Provence.
Of Provence. You're really dealing with a very, very interesting wine, but one that you better drink fairly quickly.
Yes, you have to drink rosé in the next year of being produced. I mean, this moment is very good for drinking the rosés from 2008. And the rosé will be very, very nice until, I don't know, January, February of 2010, but no more than that. So it's a bit like the Beaujolais Nouveau, that you have to drink it in just 6 months. Well, the rosé has a year of life, but no more than that.
So it's interesting. So listeners, if you're in a restaurant and somebody, a sommelier, is coming up to you and saying, now 2003 was a great year for wines from Spain, and I have a rosé, you're just going to adore, then you know this is someone who doesn't know what they're talking about.
No, not at all. Because the rosé is very fresh, it has a lot of fruit, but it's very delicate. So you need to drink it when it's very young.
Now, the first wine that we tasted this morning was interesting because it was a Chardonnay.
So yes.
Quite a large percentage of the small percentage of wines that are white are actually,
yes,
Chardonnay.
Yes, but Chardonnay in Navarra, in the cooler places, are very fruit, has a lot of fruit and a very nice acidity. So it's, I think it's something like a Chablis, with the difference from Navarre, but it's a Chardonnay from a cold place. And this is quite odd because in Spain we think that Spain is very sunny and all the places are very hot, and this is not true. In the north of Spain, it's quite cold.
But it's cold in the wintertime because it's mountainous.
Yes.
It's surprising to think about that, but the grapes actually find snow
for
parts of the year. But the real pride of Navarre, I guess, is red wines.
Yes.
And red wines that are based, if they're based on native grapes, they're Garnacha.
Tempranillo.
But also Tempranillo, which is the famous grape of the Rioja region right next door. And then a grape that we really enjoyed. There were 200% Graziano.
Yes, Graziano and Mazuelo. And those are varieties. Well, we have them in a small percentage. Normally, they are used on the blends for many wines. But today we have tasted two wines from 100% Graziano and 100% Mazuelo, which is not very normal.
And apparently it's a fairly difficult wine to make, someone told me.
Yes, it's quite difficult because Mazuelo has a very high acidity, so it's not so easy to have it only in a wine. Normally it's blended.
But if you're a winemaker of great skill, you can do that.
Yes, and if the vintage is really good. So we have tasted at 2005, that was really a great year for us.
Lara, is incidentally a winemaker. She makes wine for quite a lot of vineyards, just in case you're thinking she's just an administrator or a spokesperson for wines. She's really in the trenches, so she knows what she's talking about. And you said something very interesting. In a country where I think we think of ownership and leadership as being a very masculine thing,
the wine
trade in Navarre is different.
Yes, it's different nowadays, because at this moment in Navarre, more than the 50% of winemakers are women. So this is quite odd, because I remember when I started to work in Navarre making wines 20 years ago, well, it was quite strange to find a woman. So I remember one of the members of the winery who told me, although you are a woman, you make quite a good wine.
You make wine like a man.
Yes. He was really surprised.
Well, it's interesting because we have talked before and on the menu with winemakers from California.
Yes.
Of the female gender, and they're saying the number of winemakers is definitely increasing, and there are good reasons why.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're saying the same thing is happening in Spain. Now, there are also exotic grapes that have found their way into Navarra wines.
Yes, in Navarra we are going to find indigenous grapes as Tempranillo, Garnacha, or Biura, but we also have international grapes. I mean, we have Cabernet Sauvignon, we have Merlot, we have Syrah, and, well, they are very well adapted, because we have to think that, 500 years ago, we had those grapes because our kings were kings from France. So we have a very big relationship with France. And, well, when the phylloxera came to Spain at the end of the 19th century, well, all those varieties disappeared. But now we are rediscovering those varieties.
So it's really not a new thing. It's just a restoration of the order as it should be.
Yes, that's true. That's true. But, well, we are very proud about our garnachas and about our tempranillos. But I think we are making many interesting things with Merlot Cabernet and the blend of Merlot Cabernet with Tempranillo.
Okay, so you think that's really that's where the interest is going to lie? I mean, there's a limited amount of things you can do with Garnacha.
Yes.
Unless you make a Chateauneuf du Pape.
Yes. Yes, but I think that we have tasted a very good Garnacha, and we still have old vines of Garnacha, and the old vines in Navarra gives a very interesting grape, very fruity, very spicy. But we also have these new varieties, and I don't know which is your opinion, but I think that we have tasted very good blends this morning.
We enjoyed all the wines that we had. It was clear that some of them were at a more popular price point.
Yes.
And these are wines to look out for because they're reaching the retail market at prices that are very attractive for people who drink wine every day but don't have a huge wine budget.
Yes.
But at the other end of the scale, some very, very carefully made wines,
yes,
which are expensive, but there's a reason why, because they're made with great care. Now, you did talk about a new program for having specially designated wines. And
yes.
And we did not, there are some wines like that exist today, but we didn't have the opportunity to taste them. Can you perhaps explain that terminology?
Yes, because now in Spain, there is a new category called vino de pago. Pago in Spanish is plot. So vino de pago is wine made from a single plot. And this moment in Spain, we have 8 vino de pago, and 3 of them are in Navarra. So perhaps next year we have the opportunity of tasting them. They are, I don't know if they are very expensive, that in Spain they are about 60, 70 euros. So perhaps here in the States we are going to find them about $100.
It's going to be an interesting price point
because
there are a lot of wines that compete in that space, but it will be very interesting to try them. Now, just to put this in terminology that American listeners and listeners perhaps in Australia will understand better, this is like a single vineyard.
Yes.
But even perhaps a smaller designation than that, even within a single vineyard, a particular part of that vineyard
that's
represented by, you know, the very best grapes, very carefully selected.
Yes.
And as a result, getting a special name.
Hand-picked, and then they have the best barrels, French oak barrels. All the process is done very carefully.
Now, is there a website where people can get more information?
Yes, of course.
Go ahead.
We are making a new website that is called Navarra Wine. .com.
Okay, now that's Navarra.
See, Navarra Wine all together.
.com.
Mm-hmm.
Pilar, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. Now we're gonna have dinner very shortly.
Yes.
Do you have any idea if we have any special wine treats with dinner?
Yes, we are going to match the Navarra's wine with special dishes. I think we are going to enjoy a lot.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have to get in touch when On the Menu comes to Navarra.
Of course. Thank you very much.
Bye.
Bye.
And on the evening of a day of sampling wines from Navarra, we caught up with a chef who's one of the leading chefs in Spain and happens to be, of course, from the province of Navarra. And what's his name, sweetheart? Enrique
Martinez.
Manrique Martinez. So
you get that accent right.
And here he is talking about the kinds of things that his restaurant specializes in.
And we have a great translator. Plus, at the Navarra Wine Festival, of course, is experiencing the food of Enrique Martinez of the restaurant Meyer in Spain in Pamplona.
Cintruénigo.
Oh, okay.
Cintruénigo. Now, Navarra.
Cinduenio, okay. Yes. And in Nevada. Yes. And now, Angelica, you are one of the top 10 chefs in Spain, and considering that Spain is at the top of its game, culinary game, and one of the top cuisines in the world, that's really quite a lot. So I would like to know from you, what are the characteristics of your style? What kinds of things interest you, your philosophy of food, and tell us about why you're called the king of the vegetables.
Bueno, las características de nuestra cocina está basada principalmente en el producto.
The characteristics of our cuisine is based on the actual product in itself.
Dentro de los productos, lo más importante y lo que más nos preocupa es el tema de las verduras y las hortalizas.
So within the products that we're talking about, the most important to us are the vegetables.
Y desde hace ya unos 15 años, más o menos, venimos realizando una operación de recuperación de semillas.
So for 15 years now, we've been working on actually recuperating the seeds of the vegetables.
Queremos de verdad sea una recuperación total desde el inicio de la selección de la semilla para conseguir un cultivo ecológico.
So what we're looking to do is go back to the seed, the production of the seed, to create the highest quality vegetable there is.
Para ello contamos con fincas propias y fincas con personas que tienen mucho amor por el campo y por la agricultura y colaboran con nosotros.
So the actual gardens themselves, these gardens are either our gardens, we raise our vegetables, we grow our vegetables, or they're with partners who have the land they grow the vegetables on, but they're on our team.
So he is a gardener as well as a chef?
Yes, he is. He's a gardener as well as a chef. His family, his grandfather actually was a gardener and would bring him into the garden and show him for example, what a great watermelon is. And he'd say, and he'd hand Enrique the seeds of this fantastic watermelon to keep and hang on to.
So he's growing heirloom vegetables.
Yes, heirloom vegetables, yes.
And what are his favorite vegetables?
Principalmente la alcachofa.
He loves the artichokes.
La alubia párroca es una variedad.
It's a bean. It's a part a bean.
La borraja.
Borraja, cardamom.
Y espárrago.
And asparagus.
Y por supuesto el que más años le llevamos atendiendo es al pimiento.
And especially the pimientos, the piquillo peppers.
Well, you must be very. Do you forage as well as grow? Do you hunt for your food as well as grow it?
No, he doesn't hunt. No hunting. Principally the vegetables and making sure that the seed is the top quality so that the final product is top quality.
Are you enjoying New York?
Muchísimo.
Very much.
vengo casi todos los años últimamente a ver.
I come at least once a year here. Just to see what's going on.
Es una ciudad que me relaja mucho.
It's a very relaxing city.
I never heard that one before.
Una semana, ¿eh?
One week. Where does he eat when he's in New York?
Cuando venimos aquí me gusta recorrerlo todo.
When he comes here, he likes to like go everywhere.
Sí, me llama mucho la atención los lugares donde se da comida rápida.
He finds it really interesting the places that do fast food.
No, es que no sabría decir, no. Todo, o sea, a mí la cocina me gusta todo, ¿no? Entonces, me gusta ver todo, o sea, todo es desde el que va de la oficina y se coge una ensalada, el otro le monta una combinación de emparedados y no sé qué.
He finds it fascinating how in New York we have at our reach so many fast foods. Different varieties, not just McDonald's, but just like any party who leaves the office to run downstairs to grab a salad and to go back upstairs.
Esa organización que tienen de comer
here,
rápidamente,
and
allí no existe.
Eat that fast does not, not translate there.
Yeah, y me llama mucho la atención,
it's
porque
very,
lo hacen muy bien.
Well, I guess that's a compliment. Listeners, I wish you could experience this man in person, not just his voice, because he's totally engaging, totally charming. And what are we going to eat tonight? We're having dinner here.
Hoy vamos a cenar unos escabeches.
Some a marinade
de vieira con bogavante, con alguna verdura, lo que encontramos.
So we have a marinade of scallops and sí. Fish.
Aquí lo que hemos querido
lobster.
Hacer hoy es las técnicas del escabeche.
And today what we're going to show off is actually a technique of escabeche, which is a marinade. It's a base of vinegars, different vinegars, spice, flavor, herbs, and olive oil, of course.
I love escabeche.
Una lubina rustida.
A lubina, sea bass.
Y luego un plato muy típico de Navarra es el pato.
A traditional dish of duck.
Entonces es un simulacro como de pato lacado y pato a nuestro estilo. Es una fusión de pato.
It's a fusion of different styles of duck.
Y luego hemos de verdura lo que hemos encontrado aquí. Bueno,
and they really had enjoyed being going out to the green market here at Union Square and being able to get the freshest ingredients from what right outside of New York City.
Sí, nos adaptamos.
So they just kind of grab whatever they have available to them and they just do with what they can.
Well, this is very exciting. I'm going to get to eat this too. You were wonderful. Thank you for being such a good sport with us too. Enrique, I look forward to seeing you in Nevada.
Muchas gracias.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again. We're taking a slight detour off the wine road.
Well, sort of. We are and we aren't.
What do you mean?
Well, the subject is containers.
Well,
otherwise,
it's not wine.
Otherwise, bottles,
it's
but
water.
I guess in this case it's bottled
water.
Bottled water and the whole bottle water.
Fascinating.
Controversy covered in a fascinating book, and he is the author with some fascinating viewpoints. Viewpoints.
But you're fascinated.
I'm fascinated, and I'm bottle maniac. I think that's the answer.
Elizabeth Wright, I really and truly thought I understood the issue of bottled water until I realized I was focusing on the very obvious part of it, and I picked up your book and learned all the background about why it's really bad. Elizabeth, welcome. Your book is lovely. It's called Bottle Mania, How Water Went on Sale and Why We Bought It. And I'd say, first of all, I think that it's thoroughly researched. Secondly, it's an amazing introduction to the real issues behind the obvious ones. And thirdly, it's really beautifully written. You have such a great, graceful style of writing.
Well, thank you very much.
I thought that the issue was waste from plastic bottles. And that's apparently not the only issue, is it?
No, it's one of the issues, and it's a very visible issue because you see these empty bottles everywhere. Well, I live in a big city, and I see them in the gutter, on the street, in the park.
See them. Exactly.
I picked up about 25 crushed ones from the street in front of my house yesterday.
Just in one session of picking
just,
them up?
It had been about 3 or 4 weeks since I did it before. I usually patrol my street a little bit more frequently than that.
Well, I mean, I go into the gym, and they sell Fiji water in a bottle at $2.50 a pop, and people sign up at the desk, pick up their bottle, pay for it, and go on in to exercise. It's amazing.
And they take the rest of it with them in their SUV when they go home, and they probably throw it in the road on the way home. But Elizabeth, this is not the most obvious subject. So what was the trigger?
The trigger for writing this book was the research that I had done for my penultimate book, which is called Garbage Land: On the Secret Trail of Trash, in which I followed different streams of waste from my home in New York to their final or not-so-final resting places around the world.
And I have to get a hold of it. Peter will love that book. I have to get a hold of that and read it.
I need another scary book to read.
that book is pretty funny, actually. It's broader. And when I started it, I was not obsessed with garbage, as I have been accused of being. But I did, by the time I was done with it, become a little bit obsessed with issues of single-use packaging and disposability. And so this idea came to me from after I'd finished that book and was wondering what to write about next. I still had these search images for those empty bottles, as you do, Peter, lying around in the streets and everywhere. And I became a little obsessed with the empty bottle and wondered how we got to this point of going through about 50 billion plastic water bottles a year in this country, and how we got to the point of people drinking more bottled water than they do beer or milk.
Yeah, I think that's an astounding figure. More than we buy more bottled water than we do milk.
Yeah, and most of us have pretty decent tap water, but there's another whole part of the book. It's not a anti-bottled water book. I was quite surprised. I needed to find out why people, how we'd gotten to this point, and of course, a big part of the answer is marketing, but why did the marketing work? And so I had to look at what was right or wrong with tap water also, and that was the big surprise in the book, and I spend several chapters on municipal water supplies.
But, you know, you start really with an issue that we've been tiptoeing around is, we're with global warming, increased population, and just about everything else characteristic of a contemporary society, we're heading for a huge water crisis.
Right. We have the same amount of fresh water on this planet now that we've had for 4.5 billion years, but the population is growing quite rapidly, and the climate is warming, and so we're going to have dry places that are drier and wet places that are perversely even wetter, which isn't always great for a water system. Big intense storms rush pollutants into waterways, and it's difficult for treatment plants to keep up with it. Sometimes they shut off. So that's a problem also. So, yeah, I try to put this bottled water thing into context with this larger global situation where many people won't have access to enough water or enough good water, and why are we spending all this money moving away from public systems and our support of them to the water that's privately bottled?
Well, you say, though, that water has been contained and portable since antiquity.
Right. But people weren't leaving their houses to go 5 blocks uptown and clutching a bottle of water. Yeah, we've always contained water and moved it around, but it was never to the extreme that we've reached today. We also never thought that we had to drink 8 8-ounce glasses of water a day.
Well, that's ridiculous.
Until the marketers told us this in the 80s and the 90s, which was very clever of them to do. And it turns out that there's no medical basis for this, that most of the water that we need to drink we get in our food, and that other beverages besides water count toward those 64 ounces a day.
I actually had a urologist tell me that drinking so much water thins the bladder wall. So it's not it's not healthy.
Probably thins your blood, too.
Probably.
Now, if you drink red wine, it's all right, though. Does that reinforce the bladder wall?
I do that. So did your urologist say how much water you should be drinking?
Oh, no.
I've heard from experts, drink when you're thirsty.
That's what I've heard, yeah.
Right, and if you're exercising, you'll be thirstier and you should drink more.
Exactly.
And if it's hot out, drink more.
And somehow or other, your system will sort of know that.
Yes.
So you really don't have to force feed it.
Right.
But you come up with some really startling findings. Let's start with Poland Spring. They seem to be a target that you really shoot at rather powerfully, and it's a big part of the story.
Yeah, I shoot at Poland Spring because Poland Spring is the number one spring water brand in the company. It's ubiquitous in New York. We're part of their market. Poland Spring's identity is spring water from Maine. So all those Poland Spring bottles you see anywhere are sourced in Maine. And I knew that there was a battle going on up there in this small town called Freiburg, where Poland Spring, which is owned by Nestle, the world's largest food corporation, is trying to get their hands on more water up there. And some people think this is a fine thing, and they're okay. They think there might be some economic benefit to them. But there are many other people who are not happy with Nestle taking more water, and they don't want all these trucks running through their small rural town.
Damaging the lake, isn't it?
Well, there's one gentleman who I write about who believes that their pumping is damaging the lake, and there have been many studies done on it, and no one has definitively said they are. There's a possibility that the pumping could be affecting the lake. It's one of these he said, she said situations, and it's just very difficult to prove cause and effect. And he thinks that his well has gone dry because of the pumping. It recovers and then goes dry, and he links it with the Nestle pumping. But the studies that the town has done don't conclude this. They're inconclusive.
But the marketing of this is, it's supposed to be so much better for you, and it's somehow artisanal, and yet it's absolutely opposite in most cases.
Well, spring water brands do have more minerals in them, and some people believe that those minerals are good for you. But again, there's no evidence that they're either better for you or worse for you. And it may be very different from your city's tap water, depending where your city or your community gets its water, whether it's surface water or groundwater, and how they treat it. And I learned that your municipal tap water is a very local issue. Everyone's water is different. So you're asking whether bottled water is across the board better for you than tap water? If you live in a community with bad tap water that does not meet federal safe drinking water guidelines, then yeah, the bottled water may be better. But you can't assume that it is. Bottled water is far less frequently inspected than tap water, for one thing. But if your community isn't meeting the federal guidelines, it's likely that bottled water is better. But that's a very small minority.
Well, I was astounded, though, how many you cited all this evidence of when these bottled waters were tested, they had all kinds of awful things in them, like kerosene or benzene. And
right, that Perrier had a benzene scare in the 1990s. They had high levels of benzene.
Yeah, which they didn't handle very well at all, did they?
No.
They tried to bury it, and then that rebounded against them very badly.
Even worse, yes, and they took a hit from that, and it gave Evian a chance to surge in the market. They made much hay out of Perrier's mistakes.
So we're back to, it's not a clear, it's not black and white.
No, and that's why I had to write a whole book about it, because it's not simple, and water is different everywhere. Some bottled waters are more inspected than others. Federal regulation has been lax. We know from the news in the last 2 years that the FDA is completely overtaxed and doesn't have enough staffing or money to be inspecting all these places. And just for listeners who don't know, it's the FDA that regulates bottled water and the EPA that regulates tap water. And the bottled waters are far less frequently inspected, and when they do their tests, they're not obliged to tell the public what they found in the water. So that's why you have these private groups, these advocacy groups, testing the water on their own and reporting that they have found disinfection byproducts or lead or bacteria. They don't always say that we have disinfection byproducts in tap water sometimes also, or bacteria, and the bacteria isn't harmful. But whatever they find, it's not what you expect to find from the advertisements that tell you that these bottled waters are pure and natural, and they imply that they are better than tap, and sometimes they're not.
Now, let's pick on a slightly different area. Our son and some of his friends became greatly fascinated by this Brita water filter, and they have one on the tap in their house in South Carolina, and you're not too keen on the fact that they do very much.
Well, I use a Brita filter myself. I have a pour-through filter.
Oh, you do? So yes.
And I use it because there's chlorine in my tap water. It's a disinfectant, and, you know, it's a great thing to have your water disinfected when you're drinking from surface waters. But I don't always like the taste or smell of it, and it varies from day to day.
So the Brita and filters like that, they help with that.
Yes, they're terrific at taking the chlorine out of the water quickly.
But isn't it also, don't they use charcoal as a filter?
Yeah.
And that's supposed to be carcinogenic. That's what I read.
Where did you read that?
I read it years ago. The charcoal in these water filter systems are it becomes a carcinogen.
Of course, we're also slowly killing ourselves by using charcoal to cook our food
exactly.
as well.
Well, I mean, it's part of that same thing.
I haven't researched the charcoal, but I wonder, you use them for a certain period of time. I don't know. I can't speak to that.
Yeah, well, it's an issue.
Now, there's another area you investigated, which is mineral waters like the one, candidly, the one we favor right now. We like the flavor of it, and you said you did, too, called Gerolsteiner. We used to use San Pellegrino before that.
Which made my nails stronger, by the way.
Yeah,
now, what's the story with them?
I didn't do much investigating, but they have one of the highest levels of minerals of all the bottled waters, and I sampled it only because I'd never had it before, and I was with the bottled water expert, Michael Masha, who wrote the book Fine Waters, and we were doing a tasting, and I thought that I should sit with an expert and go through these, since I had never bought bottled water in the United States, and I had never tried any of these fancy waters, the fine imported waters. And it just stood out for me because it was so bubbly and chalky, and I liked it. But those waters that Masha talks about in his book, the sort of high-end waters, they come in glass bottles. Many of them are imported. We have some fancy waters in the U.S. also. They're, to me, not part of the problem. People aren't walking down the street swigging Gerolsteiner and tossing the bottle on the sidewalk. They do have a significant carbon footprint. That does concern me. But people aren't relying on Gerolsteiner or other fancy imported waters for their daily hydration. I'm concerned with people who think that their tap water isn't good because they have a feeling from the bottled water companies that there's something wrong with it, and then they are buying cases and cases and cases of bottled water every week, every month, and relying on it. And that, to me, is the problem. That adds up to far more of a carbon footprint and also reduces our public will to protect municipal water supplies and to insist on better treatment and, you know, infrastructure repair to deliver good water to us.
Well, the issue that you mentioned that had me sort of attacking all the water bottle people at the gym is the question of the ethics or morality of an ownership of water, ground, underground water.
Mm-hmm.
Also the ethical issues of taking a natural resource and profiting from it.
Mm-hmm.
And the way they handled the people, you know, in the community, I thought was awful in Maine.
Right. That's a big point, and one of the reasons I focused on that town. I don't know if pumping the water is harming the aquifer. I do believe that if I lived in that town, I wouldn't want more 100 truck trips going through my town.
Oh, no, that's just awful.
Yeah, and so the people in this town said no, and to me, that's enough. I believe in strong local control of natural resources and in this right of predetermination. And when the town says no to a company, the company should say, okay, thank you, and, you know, pack their bags and go away. But this company has come back over and over again and sued the town over and over again. The case has been on appeal, and the decision will be made by the Maine Supreme Court within the next month or so.
Oh, okay.
But that's the fundamental issue to me, is the town people said no, and Nestle didn't listen.
Yeah. Well, this is that you are a rebel.
Yeah, this is an absolutely fascinating book. I can't wait.
How much we can talk about it?
I can't wait to find out what you choose to tackle next.
Well, thank you very much.
But so, listeners, the book is called Bottle Mania, and you should buy a copy and read it before you buy your next case of bottled water.
What's that blue bottle tie? Something.
I don't know, but
I remember
you have case upon case upon case of water that isn't exactly what it would appear to be. I can't stand the description of the one that comes from Singapore and is actually made from
new water.
New water. It's actually comes out of a sewage treatment plant.
But that's a story. To the nth degree.
But that's a story for another day.
Yes.
Elizabeth, bottle mania, bottle shock. What could you be doing next? Thank you so much for joining us on the menu.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks, Elizabeth. Bye.
Bye. Oh, hello, Anne.
Yes.
If you put this on the website, do you ever link to authors' websites?
Sure.
Okay, bottlemania.net.
Bottlemania.net. Okay, great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
And now it's time to take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Now, I'm fascinated to know how you're going to manage the link between what we're talking about and what we're talking about now.
We're still diving into liquids.
Okay, we're fluid.
And wait, I have even more.
We're fluid. You have even more.
We're talking about a tempest in a teacup, which
you
could
say. Oh, my goodness. Well,
if it happens to be puer.
Puer.
And also, but we're going to be talking to our good friend from Numi Teas, a very fine tea company. Reem Rahim has been on the menu before. Welcome back again, Reem. I'm a great fan of your tea company.
Thank you.
And it's Numi Tea. I noted it first for its gorgeous packaging. That was the first attraction. And then I noted that you were always in the forefront of new tea adventures. Lately, we've been planning on talking about, you've gotten a new shipment of Puer tea,
mm-hmm.
and you sent us samples of this, and we're just trying to understand what exactly Puer tea is.
Sure. Well, Puer is a different classification of tea, very similar to white, green, oolong, and black tea. So they all come from the same plant, which is the Camellia sinensis plant, but depending on the leaves that are picked and how they're grown and how they're cultivated and processed, leads to a different type of tea. So white and green tea undergo different process than black tea, and puer is a whole other process of creating pu'er tea.
So tell us a little bit more about that.
Sure. So what pu'er is it's one, it's an ancient tea that was discovered by accident. That over 2,000 years ago, they would transport tea along a horse tea, along five main what they call tea horse roads. The oldest one began in the village called Pu'er in the southwestern region of China, which is the Yunnan province, the home of tea, where tea was first begun. And what they did is they would pile the tea in order to save space. They would pile the tea on horses and mules on in these caravans, and they would go across China from one side of China to the other, which is the size of the States. So you can imagine over a long period of time, what they discovered at the end of the journey was that the taste of the tea changed and the health properties also changed, were augmented. And so then that's how pu'er was discovered. And since that time, of course, they stopped processing pu'er that way, and they've learned how to process it, you know, in various facilities.
It's sort of analogous to the story of how the Chinese invented roast pork.
Yeah.
The guy had a pig and his house burnt to the ground and the pig was inside.
Oh, really? Oh, my gosh.
So they were disappointed about the horse, about the house.
Uh-huh.
But they thought the pig tasted really good.
Oh, my gosh.
So it was an accidental discovery.
Exactly. Yeah. Probably how a lot of food is discovered.
Oh, I'm sure.
Well, there's a whole bunch of mystery around this pu'er stuff. The formula is secret. You never know when you're buying it if you're getting it for real or not. You have to be really rely on people to be honest in dealing with you. And then I was talking with you about this the New York Times article that said this county in China sees its fortunes in tea leaves until a bubble bursts. And apparently they were exploited and they built up the cost of pu'er to the point that it was unrealistic and unsupportable, and then when it crashed, put a lot of farmers traders out of business.
Now, how does Numi make sure that it's getting the right stuff? Really?
Okay, so just to kind of talk about all of that is pu'er is one. It's still a guarded secret. So if you go, you know, to China and mainly in the Yunnan province, they, you know, everything's lock and key. You can't see anything. You can see things, but you can't take pictures. Very guarded, the whole processing of pu'er. And the reason that it's undergone such a huge surge in terms of cost and popularity is because of all the health properties associated with it. The last emperor's mother apparently cured her gout by drinking pu'er, and then she popularized it to the masses. There are studies that show we have studies internally that we've done that shows it has up to 32 times more antioxidants than green tea.
Really? So even though I'm drinking the green pu'er, I'm doing better than if I'm drinking straight green tea.
Yes, you are.
Good.
So a lot of antioxidants in it. In the Chinese culture, they drink it as a digestif because it breaks down fat and aids in bloating. They'll drink it with dim sum. And in our staff, we've had one woman who's reduced her cholesterol about 50 points. I just met a woman who came here the other day, and she said she's been drinking our pu'er for the last year, and she's reduced her cholesterol 100 points, and I could not believe it.
That's amazing.
I said, did you change anything else in your diet? She said, I still eat meat. I still do all that stuff. So it's, you know, that's why it has undergone such popularity. So why it's different is that pu'er is picked, the good pu'er, is picked from old wild tea trees. They're wild harvested. They're anywhere from, 100 years old to 2,000 years old.
And Numi gets the teas from this?
From these old wild tea trees. Ours are about 500 years old. They grow in the Yunnan province. And the leaves on these trees, although it comes from the same Camellia sinensis plant, are really large. They call them broadleaf teas.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, most teas are pruned to sort of waist height. They're all pruned bushes. But these old wild tea trees still exist, and that's where pu'er, that's what the good, great pu'ers come from, is these large leaves.
Now, how is this the tea that's picked by monkeys? That's a different tea. But how do you pick tea off of a really tall tree? I mean, do you have a ladder or
people climb the trees?
They climb the tree, okay.
Now the whole myth about monkeys is monkeys don't currently pick tea.
They don't, okay.
But they used to climb the trees. So they used to throw kind of stones at the monkeys to break the branches. And there's a lot of myths about monkeys and tea because...
Yeah, we've had those myths on the program before, so yeah. I'm glad the myths went away. Thank you for that.
So currently people pick tea, monkeys don't pick tea.
Well, now this is supposed to be, you can buy Pu'er for like $200 and up. Now, is this quality?
Thousands of dollars. It depends on how old it is.
I mean, is your tea that quality?
Our tea is a very good quality, but it hasn't, the ones that we're selling in tea bags have not undergone, I would say they're about 6 months old. That's their age.
Okay.
Now you have a new version coming to market, though, in the form of a brick.
In the form of a brick. And that is about a year old now. Okay. If you saved it, it's going to go up in value.
Okay. Now does it actually change? I mean, is it like wine in a bottle? In fact, it does continue to mature? Or?
Exactly. So Pu'er is considered a living tea, and let me explain the process a little bit of how it comes to be. So after they pick these large leaves, they'll pile the leaves into heaps, and they will moisten the tea leaves in the heaps. They'll cover them with burlap, and they undergo this sort of ripening and fermentation process. And then inside in the middle of the heap, it'll get to about 120 degrees Fahrenheit, and then they'll rotate it.
Okay.
And they'll do this for a period of about 60 days. So it's, again, similar to how it was compacted on these horse caravans. It undergoes a fermentation process whereby there's what's already existing in the tea, the catechins, the polyphenols, just ends up amplifying. Then they will lightly sun-dry it, and then you can, at that point, either drink it loose, which is what we're using for our tea bags, or you can then compress it and age it. But the great thing about Pu'er is regardless, no matter how you're using it, whether it's compressed, aged brick teas or it's in the loose form, it's going to continue, it's living, so it's going to continue to sort of undergo fermentation and the health properties increase, and the taste also gets better.
So this, even though you've packaged it in the form of a brick, it's still going to continue to process itself.
Oh, yes. So it's going to keep changing.
It's supposed to have healthy, beneficial, active microbes.
Exactly.
Probably has those, too.
Probably.
Beneficial microbes. It has...
Just what we need in our tea cupboard is a few microbes.
Well, it's certainly interesting. I mean, I think you might study this for ages and still not get all the answers done.
Mm-hmm.
Point out that you were co-founder and chief marketing officer of Numi Tea,
mm-hmm.
and you do a whole bunch of other things besides just the Pu'er, including your packaging is wonderful, your blossoming teas and the accessories like the glass. How about giving us your website?
Sure, it's www.numitea.com.
Great.
And thank you so much for dispelling some of the myths about Pu'er.
Sure.
And I learned Pu'er, it was a Latin word for a boy. and I guess it means something entirely different in Chinese, which is not really surprising.
Yeah. And the taste, by the way, taste is very rich and thick and malty. Well, not thick, I would say rich and malty and slightly sweet. Very bold, and it's got almost the color of coffee.
Okay,
it's a great coffee alternative.
Well, brick,
not everybody likes that, because we haven't mentioned that.
The brick distribution is new, not going to appear on the market before July, I think
July,
you said.
Yeah.
So we'll see you at the Fancy Food Show in between on Dazzling.
Are you going to be there, Rin?
Yes, I will.
Oh, good, okay.
And perhaps we can field test Pu'er brick.
Okay, that sounds good.
I just watched a whole video on how to break it down.
Yeah, we just came out with a video. It's kind of clandestine because, you know, it's a secret guarded thing, and we just, my brother went in with the video camera kind of on his hip, and he just pushed
it. Oh, no. Oh, what a naughty boy.
We blurred everybody's
faces.
Oh, that's
and
funny.
It's all about Pu'er, and it's on our website, and you can, your listeners can download it and view it. It's actually on YouTube.
I'm sure Anne's
the
already.
Whole processing of Pu'er.
I'm sure Anne's already seen it.
Yeah, I mean, I take this seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Reema, I love talking to you again, and look forward to seeing you at the Fancy Food Show in New York.
Thank you so much.
Okay, dear. Thanks. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
And as they say in the trade, that's a wrap.
Yeah, but you ruined my
I ruined you.
Well, I was going to say that Numi's tea is really very famous for its packaging, and that you certainly packaged this program very well, Rabbit.
Oh, did I? Okay, there. Yeah. Well, I'm so glad. A compliment.
And then you say it's a wrap.
And then I say it's a wrap, and you say...
Bye-bye.